what do I mean by managing emotions? It means being able to listen to one's emotions, to take them on board, to recognize that there isn't really a split between emotion and reasoning. They actually work hand in hand, and that we should be able to take account of our emotional responses and factor them in to our thinking.
Welcome. I'm your host, Nicholas Strauss, and you're listening to the Participant Observer, a space where you become aware, a place where you are the Participant Observer. And we are very happy and honored to welcome you, Dr. Haste, and thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Great. We're going to talk about identity today, which is a very complex and interesting idea, how we look at ourselves, how we identify ourselves, how we look at others and identify them, how we come to know ourselves, I suppose. And you have some very interesting ideas about identity, one of which I haven't heard described this way until I heard you speak, which is that people have what you would call competencies. And in particular, you're concerned with five competencies. Can you explain what that is to us?
Yes. I think the word competencies has been very misused in many areas. Sometimes it's just used as equivalent to skills. But actually, competencies are really more than just skills. They include skills. A competency is a general overarching orientation towards the environment, to other people, to information, which enables one to more or less effectively organize one's meaning making, organize one's management of behavior and one's reactions to people, and one can have more or less of a particular competence. So I'm not terribly interested in measuring them as such, more a way of thinking about the elements of identity. And I became interested in this because there was a lot of discussion about what it meant to have 21st century competences. And often all this meant was skills. And it was often reduced to things like literacy and numeracy and the practical school-based things. But I began to think that really we're talking about something much larger, a larger picture of the human being. So I worked out, there seemed to me to be these five competencies which reflect different areas of our interaction with the world, with other people, and with the process of meaning-making. There's no particular hierarchy in the competencies, but I do think that one particularly important one in the modern world is the one I describe as managing ambiguity. Managing ambiguity means the ability to recognize that the world is not binary, it's not simply either or. The strong tendency in our culture to think of things as either or, good or bad, if X, then not Y. Also, along with that, the idea that we should be very linear in our thinking, go towards a single closed solution, rather than recognizing that in many areas of life, actually, there are many solutions. And our problem is to decide which one is the most useful for our purposes. And this capacity to tolerate ambiguity, to manage ambiguity, I think is a crucial element of successful psychological balance. It's also extremely important in creativity. In a way, it's counter the dominant ethic that we often come across, that you should, you know, pursue a single solution, pursue one right answer and not be distracted. That is not a very effective way of managing life in general. So I regard managing ambiguity as a primary competence because it allows one so much scope to be flexible and open to all areas of one's experience or areas of one's life. We don't emphasize it enough in our education programs or in the way we talk about psychological health. A second one is the distinction between thinking and feeling. I call it managing emotion because we tend to think of emotion, again, in our culture, as getting in the way of the important things, namely reasoning. We tend to treat emotion as though it was a lower form of responding, a lower form of reacting to the world. We sometimes even put it in scientific terms that emotion resides in those parts of the brain which are earlier in our evolutionary development, which of course immediately devalues them. We place a lot of emphasis on being able to, as it were, reject emotion and to get out of emotional states into pure reason. Now, this is a kind of paradox because actually, in real life, most people actually do think emotion is important. Most people do think emotion is something to be included. You know, it's important to have a heart as well as a head. But a lot of our thinking about education and about higher forms of cognition tend to emphasize thinking over feeling. And we also tie this to some extent, to masculinity, that it's somehow more feminine to have more emotional responses, and somehow it's more masculine, therefore, by implication, somehow more superior to have a more thinking orientation. So I think managing emotions is a crucial feature. What do I mean by managing emotions? It means being able to listen to one's emotions, to take them on board, to recognize that there isn't really a split between emotion and reasoning. They actually work hand in hand, and that we should be able to take account of our emotional responses and factor them in to our thinking.
It sounds like in some ways, at certain points, that the first competency interacts with the second competency. In other words, we are challenged to tolerate the ambiguity of having mixed emotions.
Absolutely. That's really why I treat the management of ambiguity as a kind of primary. I wouldn't say an overarching or top one. But to me, managing ambiguity seems the absolutely crucial one. But as you say, managing the ambiguity of our emotions and our reasons, partly it's a matter of inside ourselves, are often torn between reason and emotion. But also in our culture, we're often told to be torn between them and make a decision. It's very interesting that neuroscience tells us, in fact, that actually when we are engaged in even the most pure reasoning, our emotional bits light up too. Quite clearly that this is reason versus emotion distinction is to a large extent an 18th century, though it goes a bit back to the Greeks as well, a distinction which just floats around. But I think we should be able to manage to use reason and emotion effectively. So that's the second one. Another one is managing community. We live in a culture, and I'd say the West, not just America, which talks about individualism, talks about being autonomous, talks about being almost like a heroic individual against the world, sort of the John Wayne image almost. In fact, we are always in a social context. We are always in an environment of other people. Even when we're alone, even when we're in our own heads, we're actually having conversations with other people or with ourselves in other contexts. And increasingly, particularly with the rise of media, which I'm going to come on to later on, the importance of being able to sustain a community relationship, to be able to sustain interaction with others, to form links with other people, not necessarily face-to-face, but I mean, digitally and virtually is fine. And I think we need to be competent to understand who our community is, not just what responsibilities we have towards them, but how to actually engage with them, how to relate and manage and organize other people. This is, of course, an extremely important part of our civic life also, because our civic life inherently is located in the community. And that's something I also think is very important.
Right.
A fourth one is what I call agency and responsibility. Now, what is agency? Agency means being able to feel one can be an effective actor in anything. For the most trivial thing, like sewing on a button, or maybe, you know, fixing and putting a new light bulb in, to having agency at the massive organizational level. Maybe you're in charge of something really, a big organization or a big group of people or a big structure or whatever. And agency is really the sense that one can be competent and effective in the world, that one can organize oneself, practical things, people. But the important thing is that sense of confidence that one can be efficacious, one can take responsibility. And it's something that we have to teach people very early on in life. But very often, sadly, people don't have the opportunity to take responsibility and be effective. We need to give kids very early in life the experiences and opportunities that they can do something and do it well and feel they've achieved something. Not achieved in the sense of doing better than other people, just doing it. Think of the delight that the kid, when they first tie their shoelaces, feels.
Right. I think that parents often accidentally run interference and sometimes intentionally run interference with children's sense of agency. I'm struck that they don't seem to know better. They want to perhaps instill manners, or they want to somehow have the child behave in a certain way because of the parent's own sense of identity. But in fact, it ends up in perhaps one way to look at it, it ends up thwarting the child's sense of agency or efficacy.
Absolutely. I think the thing is, what parents have to do is what's called scaffolding. So you allow kids to make mistakes. I mean, safe mistakes, obviously, but it's important that kids make mistakes and learn how to remedy the mistakes by trial and error. So you have to let a kid learn the various steps in being an agent. You can't rush in and say, "This is how to do it, darling," or "You did it wrong," or "Let me show you," or "Let me take it away from you."
Well, so very interestingly, it sounds like we have to use a bit of a toggle switch as a parent and as a developing human being, a child. But as the parent, we have to use this toggle switch with the ambiguity and the ability to be competent with feeling and reason. We have to look at our child and say to ourselves, okay, now hold on a moment. I'm anxious that my child doesn't know how to do this just yet. I wonder if they're feeling a lack of achievement. Maybe I should rush in. Wait a minute. Let me think about this. And here we go on this process of trying to figure out what the best thing to do is.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to recognize that most situations are very multifaceted. They're plural, which is where the ambiguity management comes in. Because I think that we do have to allow the space and tolerate the vast range. And I mean, many parents are very good at this. I mean, in a sense, you're interacting with the child all the time, every day. You know your own child. You know the child's capacities. You know where they're going to get anxious, where they're confident, where they're going to be doing something stupid or dangerous because they're overconfident. But I think in a sense, the parent often doesn't have a major problem. It seems often it's in a larger context where the child is in contact with, not with parents or even with teachers who know them, but with other adults or other situations where we can reduce the opportunities for ambiguity, and we can reduce the opportunities for agency because we feel we have to corral, say, a group of kids or a category of kids. So I think parents quite often are quite good at scaffolding kids' mistakes and recognizing the importance of allowing them to acquire this sense of agency. You see, the important thing, agency isn't just skill, nor is it just a sense of, I've achieved that, tick that, I can move on. It's actually a sense that one can engage with the world in an agentic way. And that's the key thing.
Would it be fair to say that it involves trusting oneself? In other words, that this sense of agency is almost having a given that we can rely upon our faculty should it need to come into play.
That's a part of it. It also involves risk-taking. I mean, I think the thing is you really can't get a proper sense of agency unless you're willing to take risks and know what the limits of those risks are. So if you never take risks, you can never really gain competence, obviously.
Well, that's very interesting. That leads me toward questions more specific to identity, because I would imagine that people who may not be inclined to take risks because of their personality or their nature and how they were born may not perhaps engage in activities that result in giving them a sense of agency as often or as much.
Absolutely. I think quite often if you look at situations where people have become dependent on others or on situations, you realize that they've retreated into a situation where they can't go outside this safe wall. They can't take the next steps. And they're sort of paralyzed often because they've never had the opportunity to take a risk and for it to be successful. The trouble, of course, is taking risk can also lead to failure. So you have to manage that too. You have to allow people to learn how to fail early in life without feeling destroyed by it. I think that's the key thing, to treat risk as a learning experience, to treat failure as a learning experience, not as a kind of humiliation. And I think that's where agency comes in. You have to be able to push yourself or scaffold those of who are dependent upon you to push themselves with your help to take those risks.
So it sounds like we need to encourage this scaffolding. And if it doesn't already exist as an instinct in someone, we need to teach it somehow. Are there some specific and or general ideas that parents can start to look at, gravitate toward, develop on their own?
Well, you're saying, raising some very interesting questions, because we've had at least 150 years of widely available popular material on child rearing, available to everybody, widely accepted, which in a sense are entirely consistent with the points I've been making. The idea of giving children the opportunity to push limits, to take risks, to go outside the boundaries. A vast majority of people, I think, recognize this approach to childcare. What you're raising there is particular people, categories of people or groups who have a strong view either about punishment to corral a kid in a particular way, or if not necessarily only punishment, the idea that there are orthodoxies and dogmas within which rules, within which one has to conform one's behavior. I think there is a problem there because there are certain positions we recognize, religious or otherwise, which do take a very, I would say, a really very old-fashioned view about the importance of spare the rod, spoil the child kind of thing. And I mean, that's really, in a sense, saying, look, 150 at least years of scientific research and education research on the best way to rear kids is being denied by these particular people. And that's not what you can do about that, in a sense. Right. However, there are other groups, and I'm very aware that in some religious groups, there are quite strong dogmas. But at the same time, when you have quite clear rules that some things are taboo, some things are forbidden, yet outside that, there's actually a lot of opportunity for risk-taking and for pushing the boundaries and for recognizing that sometimes breaking the rules is a good thing. So I think we shouldn't generalize too much.
Right, I agree. And also you just brought it to a very interesting focus, which is boundaries. I think boundaries, of course, are necessary, whether they're rules or emotional boundaries. It gives children and young people who are developing a limit within which they can work and actually be free within that limit and figure out when to push that limit.
Yes, I think the thing about boundaries is, as I said, going back to the ambiguity question, having boundaries which are clear is helpful because it frames, it say, frames how one makes sense of one's experience. But again, at some point, you have to say, is this boundary getting in the way of my thinking productively about this issue, including actually thinking a different boundary would be a better boundary? So rather than saying no boundaries, say actually the boundaries should be set differently because that's where what we need at this particular point in time. For example, as young people develop in childhood, there are certain boundaries that one absolutely needs to have for safety. Well, usually they're boundaries of territory or space, but they can be boundaries of activities which might be dangerous. But then, so you set those boundaries, but at the same time, then you say, okay, look, the child has now got the point where actually we have to remove those boundaries and put different ones, a different kind of boundary. So rather than saying you shouldn't touch that object, whether it's, say, it's a knife, you mustn't play with that knife, it's dangerous. You say, right, we're now going to go out, we're going to use sharp knives, and we're going to use sharp knives in all kinds of areas. We're going to set new boundaries. In other words, boundaries within which you don't use your sharp knife because for different reasons. But within that boundary, you do use your sharp knife extremely effectively and with skill. So you see, that can be an analogy from everything from sharp knives to sex to even recreational drug use, if that's something you think is an acceptable behavior.
Right. And I imagine, just as we were talking about the possible problems with having two rigid parenting style that would involve many rules or regulations, it's just the opposite could possibly result in problems as well. There's a big trend now, or it has been going on for years, called helicopter parenting, in which parents who do too much for their children and actually try to get their children to experience a lot of life before they might be ready to are causing many issues for their children in terms of understanding their competencies.
A lot of it's also dependent on the relationship between the child and the parent, and of course on the child's own characteristics and personality. I mean, one of the arguments of some progressive education was that you basically let kids have almost complete freedom because they will form their own rules when they discover the consequences of their actions. Now, yes, some kids do. Many kids do, actually. But on the other hand, some kids don't. And if you look at the successful experiments of fairly extreme progressive education, what you actually see is that there was a kind of adult structure around which was constantly monitoring what was happening with the kids and tactfully intervening in how a child would protect it from its own potential actions and dangers. If you look, for example, and it's old-fashioned now, but A.S. Neale's book Summerhill, which is an experiment in very very progressive education, what you actually see there is that although the kids had enormous freedom inside the school, Neale himself was always there as a kind of father figure, if you like, an authority figure who was always going to protect them if things got out of hand. So I think that idea of, you know, when you set apparent freedoms, you often have to do it with a sort of a context of a not very evident, but actually quite strongly available. If you like, it's a safety net. So, but I mean, I think a lot of this depends very much on the parent-child relationship, because how a particular parent can manage their own anxieties in relation to their child's activities, it varies hugely.
Right. Well, there's so much of a parent that the child internalizes.
Yes.
And again, this is very much a part of our identity, right? There are things that are transmitted in nonverbal ways. And so we internalize our parents' behavior and the people around us, their behavior, not just what they say or what they...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we learn an awful lot from the interaction, not just the behavior as watching one's parent do something, but actually how the interaction between the parent and the child and between parent and other adults. And also another thing which actually hasn't been talked about a lot, but I think is very important, is how the parent interacts with what I call cultural narratives. What I mean by that is all the stuff you get through media and through how people talk about things. One thing which we haven't talked about perhaps as much as we should in child development is the importance that we're surrounded by stories. Basically, we tend to think that we communicate information by logical processes. We tend to think that if you want to tell somebody something, you tell it in a way which is a logical sequence, if A, then B, then C, that kind of thing. And that the most effective communication is that kind of rather structured, formalized, the kind of thing you get in certain disciplines in school, for example. Obviously math, but not only math. But actually, when you look at it, a very, very large amount of our information, our knowledge, our understanding comes from stories. And the stories are in all kinds of forms. Let me explain what I mean by this. When you tell somebody a story, as opposed to a logical sequence of facts, you have implicitly an origin, a background. Something has happened before the events you're describing. It takes place in the context. So you've got some kind of causal assumptions about why things are as they are today in this context. And then you've got consequences. Frequently, stories go into what will happen next. And of course, we very explicitly use that in many moral stories where we say, well, if you behave like that, terrible things will happen to you, etc. Or good things will happen to you. But it isn't always explicit. And then what's happening in the middle of the story, what the actual story itself is what's happening. And in that telling of the story, there's a huge amount of information about the values which are being conveyed, the kind of person you're supposed to be, the kind of skills you're supposed to have, the kind of qualities you're supposed to have. Let's take the three bears, the story of the three bears, okay? You know what happens in the story of the three bears. You've got the archetypal nuclear family with archetypal gender roles and archetypal generational roles and the provision of the porridge by the mother and all the other things. A lot of detail in that story. And there's a kind of origin factors, you know, you immediately know they come from a particular kind of family environment with particular relationships. It's all there without even saying it. And then along comes this creature, Goldilocks, who, interesting enough, is a different species, a point which isn't usually made explicit. And Goldilocks is clearly not very well brought up. Tell me how you tell the story. Goldilocks is very curious. Part of Goldilocks' problems is that she's a very curious little girl.
Well, maybe she's developing her sense of agency.
Absolutely. She's a very agentic little girl, is Goldilocks. But she also seems to lack certain boundaries. I mean, she does rather rush into things a little bit and consequently breaks them, basically. And then, so you know the story. And at the end of it, of course, they come back and whatever happens. Actually, I've forgotten the end of Goldilocks, but basically whatever happens, happens. But it's a little story, but it's extremely influential and every kid learns it very early on. But if you unpack the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, there's a huge amount of narratives, causality, origins, values, beliefs, consequences, ideal types, stereotypes, etc. They're all there in this tiny little story, which you could actually tell in one page, let alone what you get on soap operas, you know. You don't have to go as far as soap operas. You can say it's there in Goldilocks.
This is Nicholas Strauss. Thank you for joining us for part one of my conversation with Dr. Helen Haste. If you'd like to participate some more, please visit us on the web at www.theparticipantobserver.com. where you'll find all things related to the Participant Observer. We'd love to hear from you because you are the Participant Observer.